of America.
Today is Thursday, April 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. India detects a double mutant strain of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19.
It has, you know, mutations from two different sets of variants. However, you know, like I said, you know, all of these variants, in fact, have multiple mutations.
Plus, the World Economic Forum says women will have to wait over 135 years to achieve global gender parity. We'll have these stories and more next. On Wednesday, the Pan American Health Organization said countries in the Americas could see a worse surge in coronavirus cases than the previous surge last year, with Brazil, Uruguay, and Cuba already suffering more. Director Carissa Etiane said the end of the Southern Hemisphere summer, following holidays where people grouped together and spread cases, had prompted spikes. She urged citizens to stay at home and governments to think hard before lowering movement restrictions. So far this year, nearly 20 million COVID cases and 475,000 related deaths have been reported in the Americas. In India, the health secretary has told officials to address lax coronavirus prevention measures to prevent healthcare systems from being overwhelmed by a surge in infections. India's current caseload of 12.1 million ranks third behind only the United States and Brazil, with testing unable to keep up with demand. The daily rise in cases has quadrupled in the space of a month. Last week, India discovered a new variant described by officials as a double mutant. And while not a scientific term, epidemiologists use it to refer to an entirely new variant that has the characteristics of two that have already been identified. Now, to learn more, I spoke with Paolo Verratti, Associate Professor of Virology and Vaccinology at the University of Connecticut.
All of these variants of concern that we have been hearing about, the UK variant, the Brazil variant, the South Africa variant, they all actually have multiple mutations and not just one single mutation. So what is different, perhaps, about the India so-called double mutant variant is that one of the mutations was actually similar to the Brazilian and the South African variant. And the other mutation is actually, you know, similar or actually identical to the California variant, because we also have, you know, the two California variants. So that's why it's being called a double mutant, because it has, you know, mutations from two different sets of variants. However, you know, like I said, you know, all of these variants, in fact, have multiple mutations.
So when it comes to these mutations, you know, there's been a lot of discussions about how effective vaccines that have been developed against the original SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, you know, some of the studies showed that they were less effective against the variants that were first found in the United Kingdom, in Brazil, in South Africa. When you have something that is a double mutant, what does that mean in terms of how effective a vaccine could be in terms of addressing those kinds of illnesses?
Okay, so for all of these variants, first of all, you know, they all increase transmission of the virus, so transmissibility, right? And that's not surprising because the novel coronavirus is essentially still adapting to humans as a host, right? But like you said, you know, they do show some reduction in the neutralization that can be provided by antibodies, either from people that got natural infection, so this is convalescent plasma or serum, or people that actually got vaccinated. So there is, you know, sometimes a minimal, sometimes a moderate, and sometimes a more severe reduction in neutralization, in the neutralization ability of these antibodies to neutralize the virus. This is under intense scrutiny. So the reality is we don't know exactly how that's going to translate in the case of, you know, people once you know, they have been naturally infected or have been vaccinated, and then it, once they get this new variant. So we have reason to believe that, you know, that vaccine efficacy may be reduced And I think, you know, honestly, that there will be a reduction in the efficacy of the vaccines, but I don't think that it will be that the vaccines are going to be ineffective. They're still going to have, you know, residual cross-protection, essentially, against these variants. And that's because, you know, when we think about immunity, we usually think about antibodies. We also have to remember that we have more than antibodies. We have T-cell responses that also help in protection. So when you put those two together, it's very likely that we are still going to be able to have cross protection. In the long term, however, you know, things are a little bit unclear. I mean, it's very likely that we're going to have newer variants. In fact, not just these India, you know, double mutant, but other types of variants that will emerge. And it is potentially we could have a variant of high consequence, not just of concern, but one that actually, you know, indeed can cause more severe disease and evade the immune, the prior immune response more efficiently. So we have to really get prepared, you know, for what may be coming our way.
Speaking of what may be coming our way, the vaccines are starting to roll out, and healthcare professionals have said that getting vaccinated is vital to achieve herd immunity. But we're seeing an increase in cases, surges, they're being called, not only in the United States, but in India and elsewhere. What do you make out of why we're seeing a surge at this point in time?
Well, some of them are really caused by the new variants, right? So they all have this enhanced transmissibility. So, for example, in the case of Brazil, where I'm from, there is the so-called P1 variant, is the Brazil variant. It has caused really an explosion in the number of cases, you know, since January. However, it's not just that. Like you mentioned at the beginning, you know, it could be really due to, you know, the relaxing that we are having in terms of social distancing, use of masks, you know, that type of thing. The message here really is we are not out of the woods yet. So take-home message is keep doing whatever we've been doing because it has worked for us. And we're going to have to keep doing it even after we get vaccinated.
Paolo Verratti teaches at the University of Connecticut, where he's an associate professor of virology and vaccinology. Pfizer and BioNTech say its COVID-19 vaccine is safe, effective, and produces robust antibody responses in 12 to 15-year-olds. Reuters' Freddie Joyner has more.
The new study offers the first evidence of how the vaccine will work in school-age adolescents, putting the two companies ahead of other Western vaccine developers in the quest to protect children from the virus. A trial by Moderna to test its COVID-19 vaccine in children aged 6 months to less than 12 years was launched this month, while Johnson & Johnson has yet to begin a planned trial. AstraZeneca in December removed children from a mid to late stage trial of its COVID-19 vaccine in Britain. The Pfizer-BioNTech trial was of 2,260 adolescents aged 12 to 15. There were 18 cases of COVID-19 in the group that got a placebo shot and none in the group that got the vaccine, resulting in 100% efficacy in preventing COVID-19, the company said in a statement. The vaccine was well tolerated, with side effects in line with those seen in the earlier adult trial. Last week, the companies gave the first vaccine doses in a series of trials testing the vaccine in younger children that will eventually go to those as young as 6 months of age. Pfizer's chief executive, Albert Bourla, said the company planned to seek emergency authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, quote, in the coming weeks and to other regulators around the world. He added that he hopes to start vaccinating the younger age group before the start of the next school year.
Freddie Joyner from Reuters News. Europe's medicines regulator has reiterated its backing of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine, saying no particular group of age, sex, or previous medical history was especially susceptible to blood clotting after receiving the shot. However, while repeating that the vaccine's benefits outweigh the risks, it cautioned that people should be aware of the remote possibility of rare blood clots occurring and must seek immediate medical attention in case of symptoms. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. The World Economic Forum says women will have to wait over 135 years to achieve global gender parity. The forum's Global Gender Gap Report 2021 finds that the impact of COVID-19 has set back efforts to close the gender gap by generation. Lisa Schlein explains.
For the 12th consecutive year, Iceland tops the rankings as the most gender-equal country in the world, followed by Finland, Norway, New Zealand, and Sweden. Two African countries, Namibia and Rwanda, enter the rankings of 156 countries in 6th and 7th place, with Switzerland rounding up the top 10. Afghanistan is at the bottom of the ranking survey. The United States has moved up 23 positions to number 30. Authors of the report say that jump in gender parity is due to improvements in the new makeup of the U.S. administration. China is in the top half of the G20 and is ahead of all emerging markets with the exception of Russia. In another advance for gender equality, the United Arab Emirates has broken into the top half of the rankings, the first Arab country to do so. The report finds women face many hurdles in the workplace, hurdles made worse by the pandemic. World Economic Forum Managing Director Sadia Zahidi says many more women than men have lost jobs because of COVID-19 lockdowns. She says women also assume greater responsibilities in housework, child, and elder care in the household.
The sectors that have been the most impacted by the lockdowns across the world tend to be sectors that are also large employers of women. So the consumer and retail sector that has been impacted globally, the travel and tourism industry that has been impacted globally, these are all sectors that tend to be large employers of women.
Another problem that will further handicap women's ability to move ahead in the post-COVID-19 period is the changing face of work. Sue Duke is head of global public policy at LinkedIn. She says women are not well represented in fast-growing jobs of tomorrow, such as cloud computing, engineering, and AI data products.
We have seen a rapid acceleration in digitization and technology being integrated into all aspects of our lives. We have to have women's voices, perspectives represented at that foundational formative stage and playing an equal role in what technology is developed, how it's deployed, and precisely what impact it's going to have.
The report says Western Europe continues to be the best performing region, with nearly 78% of its overall gender gap closed. North America, comprising Canada and the United States, comes in a close second. The report finds sub-Saharan Africa has made slow progress and that it will take 121.7 years to close the gender gap, given the present rate of improvement. South Asia is the second lowest performer. However, the report says the Middle East and North Africa continue to be regions with the largest gender gap to be closed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Judges at the International Criminal Court in The Hague have upheld the acquittal of former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo and Youth Minister Charles Blaye Goudé, paving the way for both of them to return home. The two have been accused of instigating post-election violence, and observers say there are concerns that their return could again destabilize Ivory Coast, the world's largest producer of cocoa. Lisa Bryant has the details.
Former President Laurent Gbagbo and Charles Blaye Goudé were in the courtroom for the verdict. Blaye Goudé smiled widely as presiding judge Chili Eboué Ousoudji read it out.
The appeals chamber by majority has found no error that could have materially affected the decision of the trial chamber in relation to either of the prosecutor's two grounds of appeal. It therefore rejects the prosecutor's appeal and confirms the decision of the trial chamber.
The judge also revoked all remaining conditions on the men's release. Former President Gbagbo, who has been staying provisionally in Belgium, has said he wants to return to Ivory Coast, where he remains a heavyweight in the opposition against current President Alassane Ouattara. In a statement, Gbagbo's defense team hailed the acquittal, saying justice had been done. In 2019, ICC judges acquitted Gbagbo and Blaye Goudé over crimes against humanity charges protests related to a wave of post-electoral violence in Ivory Coast in 2010 and 2011. The vote saw Ouattara defeating Gbagbo, who refused to concede. Following an investigation of alleged atrocities that included perpetrating murder and rape, Gbagbo became the first former head of state to be arrested on orders of the ICC. The prosecution appealed the initial acquittal on procedural grounds, all of which were dismissed by the appeals judges, with two of them dissenting. In some cases, Judge Ebwe Osuji offered particularly strong criticism of Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda's arguments, including her apparent suggestions that the first court hadn't fully considered all the evidence before coming to its verdict.
Judges of the ICC are presumed to act with integrity and impartiality. The appeals chamber would expect evidence of a very clear nature to support such a serious allegation as was made.
Wednesday's ruling amounts to yet another setback for the ICC prosecution. Judges previously acquitted on appeal former Democratic Republic of Congo Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba. Prosecutor Bensouda earlier dropped crimes against humanity's charges against Kenyan leader Uhuru Kenyatta. Bensouda is also under U.S. sanctions for launching an investigation into war crimes by U.S. troops in Afghanistan. However, champions of the 20-year-old ICC argue that its mission as a court of last resort, taking on extraordinarily difficult cases against powerful figures, is extremely challenging from the start. Bensouda's 9-year term is up in June. She will be succeeded by British prosecutor Karim Khan. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The trial of Derek Chauvin, the police officer charged in the death of George Floyd, continued Wednesday in the U.S. state of Minnesota. The court proceedings included testimony from the convenience store cashier who sold cigarettes to Floyd moments before his deadly encounter with Chauvin. Christopher Martin testified that he knowingly accepted a fake $20 bill from Floyd for the cigarettes, even though that the money would be subtracted from his paycheck in accordance with the store policy. Martin expressed regret in video coverage of the hearing carried by Court TV.
We saw you standing there with your hands on your head for a while, correct?
Correct.
What was going through your mind during that time period?
Disbelief and guilt.
Okay. Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
Martin was among several people who have testified about their frustration and anger as they witnessed Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck outside the convenience store last May. Chauvin kneeled on the back of Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds as Floyd cried repeatedly and he could not breathe. Chauvin, who was white, was fired by the city's police department the day after Floyd, an African American, died in custody. The officer is facing charges of murder and manslaughter and has pleaded not guilty. A top U.S. border official says he expects more than 1 million migrants will arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border this year, a sign of a growing humanitarian challenge for U.S. President Joe Biden on the southwest border. Reuters reporter Brian Wood.
In South Texas, over 4,000 migrants are crammed into one facility, four times its capacity before the global health crisis. Most are unaccompanied minors. The Biden administration allowed reporters to tour this processing facility in Donna on Tuesday. Acting executive officer for U.S. Border Patrol in the region, Oscar Escamilla, said many of the children have gone through long and harrowing journeys on their own.
These kids cross by themselves. Obviously, the parent pays a fee to the smuggler. The cartel member or the smuggler at this point will bring the kid over. We'll bring him to the river. We'll hand him over to the raft. We'll place them in a raft and say, okay, go. When you get to the other side, they'll explain to them there's going to be an officer. They'll explain what we wear and tell them, turn yourselves into them.
A top U.S. official said on Tuesday he expects more than 1 million migrants to arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border this year, a growing humanitarian challenge for President Joe Biden, as more people are driven to the border by poor economic conditions, natural disasters, and hope to stay in the U.S. under his administration. The Donna facility footage shared with Reuters showed young children sitting inside a playpen, some as young as 3 years old. More than 2,000 unaccompanied children have been held here for longer than a legal limit of 72 hours. Escamilla says these kids slipped through the cracks of the immigration system.
There's a little girl that I talked to a little while ago. She said that she had lost her mom and that she doesn't have a father. So she's coming into this country because her uncle is going to be the sponsor. So they want to take this little girl is going into the States. And I asked her, what state are you going to? What's your final destination? She said, I don't know. All I know is that it snows there. That's all I know.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security said in a statement they were, quote, working around the clock to quickly move children out of the packed border facilities. The Government Health and Human Services Refugee Office did not immediately respond to a request for comment.
Reuters' Brian Wood. The Pentagon is reversing Trump-era policies that largely ban transgender people from serving in the U.S. military. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
Defense officials tell the AP the new regulations will allow transgender Americans who meet military standards to enlist and serve openly in their self-identified gender. They'll also have more access to medical care and gender transition. President Biden signed an executive order days after taking office, immediately banning any service members from being forced out of the military on the basis of gender identity. Until 2016, transgender people could be discharged, but the Obama administration changed the rules. Shortly after taking office, Donald Trump surprised the Pentagon by tweeting transgender troops would not be allowed to serve in any capacity. Sagar Magani, Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
The giant impact theory is the most popular hypothesis on the moon's formation. It proposes the moon was made from the debris left after a violent collision between a young Earth and Theia, a Mars-sized protoplanet, some 4.5 billion years ago. At the recent Lunar and Planetary Science Conference, a team of Arizona State University researchers presented a study that proposes that some of the remains of Theia are still embedded deep inside Earth, between the lower mantle and core. After constructing simulations of the giant impact event, the ASU researchers theorize what's left of the protoplanet make up what scientists call large, low shear velocity provinces, or LLSVPs. Scientists say there are two of these gigantic modules of material. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A group of Iraqi women has taken on the risky task of demining the city of Basra, defying gender norms and attempting to clear the area of landmines and other explosives left after the war. Reuters' Emily Wither has that story.
Suited up in protective gear, a team of women fan out across the rugged fields of Basra. Defying rigid gender norms in Iraq, they search with careful precision for dangerous explosives. Hind Ali explains why she joined the all-female demining team.
The main reason I joined the team is a humanitarian one. Vast areas of the province of Basra have a lot of mines. People have been prevented from living on those lands. Moreover, there's a lack of awareness among some people that has caused countless accidents in the province of Basra.
Ridding their province from landmines, the 14 women were trained over the course of 40 days, equipping them with the tools and knowledge to find and safely clear different types of mines. The difficulty and danger of the task, however, was not their only obstacle, but rejection from their community for women to take up such tasks has also proven difficult.
Until now, no one has encouraged me in this field because, well, you know, families are worried. Just hearing the term demining causes immense fear for many people, especially with parents and close relatives. Even now, my family and close friends are completely against it.
Over the past years, mines have killed and injured dozens of Iraqis in the east and west of the city. In Basra, there are thousands of kilometers still full of mines as a result of the Iraq-Iran war and the Gulf War. With each piece of new ground cleared, these women are saving lives.
Reuters reporter Emily Wither. A team of South Africans has won a Cape Town competition to create a zero-carbon home just ahead of Earth Day on April 22nd. Experts say the house design, which incorporates solar power, passive cooling, rainwater harvesting, and a food garden, can help reduce the nation's carbon footprint. Vinicius Assis reports.
A team of nine South African students and young professionals won the first My Clean Green Home, a local building and design competition. The contest challenged designers to build a house that produced no carbon emissions with a budget of just $12,000.
It's a good way to bring what we believe and what we study to the general public and to actually share this with the city of Cape Town and the festival to actually educate people more about net zero carbon buildings.
Despite the small size, just 7 square meters, the house's quality surprised the public.
Being green is always expensive, so it can't be rolled out to everybody. But if this is sustainably, economically viable, then it makes a lot of sense.
Cape Town authorities say buildings consume 38% of the city's energy and generate 58% of its carbon emissions. They aim to have all new city buildings carbon neutral from 2030.
People can take elements of this home and bring it into their own houses, or they can rethink what a house might be.
South African green building experts say the net zero concept should not be limited to Cape Town. Net zero refers to when emissions are balanced by absorbing an equivalent amount from the atmosphere.
My Clean Green Home project could definitely be applied nationally. It is an example of a project that is net zero. You can go and see it. It's been built during COVID. It's been built with materials that we already have available. And that shows that it is possible.
South Africa has for years suffered rolling power cuts that leave people without electricity for hours at a time. The country's power problems could ironically help drive more South Africans to net zero buildings. Vinicius Assis for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
And finally, Boogie, a recent film by Chinese-American filmmaker Eddie Huang, addresses stereotypes Asian people face in the United States. Lead actor Taylor Takahashi spoke with VOA's Penelope Pulu about his film character and Asian representation in the film.
No one believes in an Asian basketball player.
Have mercy on my soul.
It's a joke in this country. We can cook, clean, count real good, but anything else, we pick last.
Boogie, a Chinese-American high school student and a talented basketball player, dreams of joining the NBA, a spot in the U.S. professional league. Despite his impressive performance, he's rejected by college scouts while his family faces bankruptcy. Japanese-American actor Taylor Takahashi told VOA that, like his character, he excelled at basketball in high school.
I kind of went to basketball because it was the sport that people would raise their eyebrows at. As a 5'8", 5'9", you know, Asian kid, it's one of those things that, like, you're not supposed to be good at this.
And that's the film's message, defying Asian-American stereotypes, says Takahashi.
We do very similar things as everyone else does in this country, and we want to be seen in that light. We want to normalize it and not just be, you know, tagged in this box of kung fu master or nerd or scientist or doctor, and get, you know, kind of, you know, trapped in that stereotypical box.
Takahashi says that since the film's release, he has been approached by Asian viewers, thanking him for showing a more nuanced depiction of their experience in America. But he adds, the film also expresses the immigrant experience at large.
It's not just an Asian, you know, story. We're Asian vehicle and basketball is the vessel, but everyone can relate to this.
Takahashi adds that American communities need to become more vocal against the rising anti-Asian violence during the pandemic.
We never expected to have freedom or independence or equality, any of these things you ABCs expect to have in this country.
Boogie director Eddie Huang has grounded Boogie on his personal experiences of facing prejudice.
I've faced abuse and violence my entire life for being Asian. You know, like when I was five, a kid pushed me off the slide and broke my arm. But right now, it seems to be really peaking for our community, and it's a real problem.
Wang says the basketball drama explores themes of family dynamics, identity, and perceptions of being other in America.
And I would just encourage everyone in their communities to educate each other, educate your family and friends, and just remind them that we're all human.
So what are you going to do?
He hopes his film serves as a reminder of that. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.